Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Aerospace Advantage podcast brought to you by the Mitchell Institute for Aerospace Studies. I'm your host, John Slickbaum, and as a career fighter pilot, I've mentioned that aerospace power is my passion. And our mission here at the Aerospace Advantage podcast is to explore and examine the technologies, strategies, operating concepts, and perspectives of the aerospace domain that will prove crucial for our nation today and into the future. Today, we're going to dig into a problem that has long plagued the service. Trying to buy a modern aircraft inventory, or more appropriately, utterly failing to do so. The reality facing Air Force airmen today is that they are taking to the skies an aircraft that are older than they are. And we're not just talking by a year or two, by decades in many cases. A future Air Force fighter pilot will spend a good portion of time training in the T-38. Many of you have seen the jet. It looks awesome. But did you know the newest one the Air Force owns is over 50 years old? There are some that date back to the Kennedy administration in the 1960s. That's over half a century of students hammering on these jets with hard landings, overgees, and an occasional round of air sickness as they learn to fly the basics of advanced flying. When they get to their fighter assignments, the majority of these pilots will be flying the F-16 and the F-15, which were procured during the Reagan administration. Same with the A-10. The newest one was bought in 1984. That's 2 years before Tom Cruise made the F-14 legendary in Top Gun. I'm here to tell you that fighter jets age fast. The Gs, the speed, weapons loadouts, living outside in the weather, and 3 decades worth of nonstop combat deployments, they all take their toll. The problem is not just with trainers or fighters. The newest B-52 was procured before the 1962 missile crisis, and the B-1s were all fielded before the World Wide Web was invented. C-17s, often viewed as a new airlifter, entered the inventory nearly 30 years ago. And the KC-135, the backbone of the aerial refueling fleet, were fielded before the U.S. became involved in Vietnam. I can go on, it's a long list. None of this is anything to be proud about or sentimental. These are combat aircraft, not museum pieces. Airmen have to fly in a harm's way in these planes, and the simple reality is that if things don't change, these folks will get shot down because the aircraft are way past their prime. Would you put a 60-year-old quarterback in an NFL game expecting him to do well? The reason why all new combat aircraft involve things like stealth, advanced sensors, tons of processing power is because it's essential for getting the job done, coming home safe, and being able to go out and do it again the next day. And it's not just that the Air Force aircraft inventory is old, it's also too small. In fact, it's never been so old or so small going all the way back to the service's founding in 1947. Did you know that we only have 157 heavy bombers in our nation? Of these, just 20 are the stealthy B-2. These shortfalls are reflected in nearly every mission category. This matters because Air Force aircraft are in high demand. When you don't have large inventories, you fly the ones you have and you fly them hard. This strain breaks aircraft that are already fragile from their advanced age. You want proof? Last year, after nearly 2 decades of nonstop combat deployments, the Air Force had less than 10 B-1 bombers capable of flying combat missions. That's out of 60 in the inventory. The rest were all broken. And it's not just about the jets. Small inventories strain the crews, both air crews and maintainers. So that's the problem statement for today's show. The Air Force aircraft inventory is old, small, and that means it is exceedingly fragile. Combat aircraft are not just for show. They protect and defend America's interests around the globe. The reality is that our adversaries, ranging from peer states like China and Russia to terrorist organizations like ISIS, they see things differently than America, and they're not shy about pushing past boundaries we would consider non-negotiable. These hostile ambitions are also increasingly backed up by highly capable military means. There is no silver bullet to address these challenges. Therefore, hard military power is an indispensable part of the equation. So if aerospace power makes so much sense on so many levels, then we've got to ask, what happened? Why do we now have the smallest, oldest Air Force in our nation's history? And what does this mean for the future? Resourcing for the Air Force has run thin throughout the 1990s, with leaders focused on downsizing the military in the wake of the Cold War. We won, and folks wanted to save cash. Inventory for things like bombers, fighters, they were reduced by half, and ranks of space professionals were cut too. That said, the force was not in dire straits just yet, given that the Reagan military buildup had modernized the core elements. This buildup in the 1980s, along with the aircraft bought during the early days of the Cold War, would underwrite most of what the Air Force would rely upon for the next 30 years. So to better understand this context, let's get with Mark Gunzinger, callsign Gonzo, Mitchell's Director of Future Concepts and Capability Assessments, to tell us his story. Mark was an Air Force bomber pilot and retired from the Air Force. He went on to become the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Defense of Forces Transformation and Resources, and has also been on the National Security Council staff. So Mark, when did the U.S. Air Force really start to lose attention and funding?
So, Slick, the short answer is the Air Force's budget began to drop immediately after the Cold War and has yet to recover to the level needed to modernize and grow the size of its forces to meet requirements in this era of great power competition. In fact, compared to the Army and Navy departments, the Air Force absorbed the largest cuts to its annual budgets after the Cold War. Now, let me cite just one statistic that I find shocking. From 1989 to 2001, the Air Force's blue-only budget, which excludes funding that it doesn't control for national intelligence and other priority programs, dropped by about a third. And over that same time frame, its procurement budget dropped by an amazing 52%. And that goes a long way toward explaining why the Air Force now has an Air Force inventory of aircraft that is its oldest and smallest ever. Now, it's true the defense budget increased after 9/11 to support overseas operations and to buy capabilities needed to counter terrorist groups. However, most of the Air Force's aircraft procurement funding in the years after 9/11 was directed toward buying remotely piloted aircraft and recapitalizing parts of its mobility force, not toward next-generation capabilities that are needed to defeat great power aggression. And Obama administration defense cuts and the 2011 Budget Control Act blew additional holes in the Air Force's budget that it filled by further reducing its forces and strength and modernization investments. One last point, there are still some who believe that the Air Force, Navy, and Army receive roughly equal shares of the defense budget, and nothing is further from the truth. In fiscal years 2010 and 11, the Air Force's percentage of the defense budget was about 19.4%, counting its blue budget only, and no other service has ever reached such a low percentage. And although the Air Force's budget share slowly increased during the Trump administration and reached 23% in 2020, that's still far short of the mythical one-third, one-third, one-third for the three service departments.
You know, in thinking about this, a lot of the dynamics that you're raising here are epitomized by the F-22 Raptor, our most advanced fighter, whose buy was prematurely cut at less than half of what we should have bought. And by that, I mean, we got 187 of these fighters, not the 381 the Department of Defense validated that was the no-kidding requirement. So, Gonzo, what happened here?
Well, just to clarify, the Secretary of Defense, not the Secretary of the Air Force, decided to procure only 187 F-22s instead of the Air Force's required 381 aircraft. And for that matter, the SECDEF also decided to buy only 21 of the Air Force's required 132 B-2s. Now, Secretary Gates' decision to terminate the F-22 program early was the end result of a campaign mounted by a small group of civilian analysts on his staff who were driven primarily by budget considerations, not analyses of China's accelerating military modernization. And Gates' overriding priority during the last part of the Bush administration and in the early years of the Obama administration was to fund counterinsurgency capabilities, not next-generation weapon systems that are now critical to maintaining our nation's warfighting advantage over China and Russia. And the earlier decision to buy only a handful of stealth B-2s was similarly short-sighted. And that decision came out of DoD's 1997 Quadrennial Defense Review, which discounted the need for stealth aircraft and the need for more long-range strike capacity, both of which are now among the Pentagon's top priorities. So those are just two examples of why budget-driven planning usually results in a force that is best suited for fighting wars of the past and not the future.
In fact, let's hear an excerpt from a speech from back then when Secretary of Defense Robert Gates was fighting to kill the program.
I concluded that 183, the program of record since 2005, plus four more added in the FY09 supplemental, was a sufficient number of F-22s and recommended as such to the President. The reaction from parts of Washington has been predictable for many of the reasons I described above. The most substantive criticism is that completing the F-22 program means we are risking the future of U.S. air supremacy. And so to assess this risk, it's worth looking at the real-world potential threat and assessing the capabilities that other countries have now or in the pipeline. Consider that by 2020, the United States is projected to have nearly 2,500 manned combat aircraft of all kinds. Of those, nearly 1,100 will be the most advanced fifth-generation F-35s and F-22s. China, by contrast, is projected to have no fifth-generation aircraft by 2020. And by 2025, the gap only widens. The U.S. will have approximately 1,700 of the most advanced fifth-generation fighters versus a handful of comparable aircraft for the Chinese.
So, Gonzo, a decade later, what do you think about Secretary Gates' assertions?
They were incredibly short-sighted, and the impact of his F-22 decision is still being felt today. Because F-22 production was canceled, the Air Force had to extend the life of its existing F-15Cs, which are now aging out. In fact, the Air Force is being forced to buy new-build F-15EXs because of the need to retire F-15Cs. And let's not forget that F-35A full-scale production, which could have helped replace some aging F-15s, was also repeatedly delayed and is still far below production rates that were projected less than a decade ago due to budget shortfalls and other reasons. In fact, not including trainers and small UAVs, the Air Force has recently been buying about 100 total aircraft per year, of which less than 70 have been combat aircraft. And by comparison, the Air Force bought an average of more than 220 combat aircraft each year from 1982 through 1989. So to put that in context, since 2000, the Navy has bought more combat aircraft than the Air Force. And from fiscal year 2008 to 2019, it bought more new aircraft of all types than the Air Force. And despite Trump-era budget increases, the Air Force's $10.8 billion aircraft procurement budget in fiscal year 2020 was about half of what it spent on new aircraft each year during the Reagan administration. So let's go beyond the numbers for a minute. The Air Force's F-22 force is stretched incredibly thin by current operation requirements and will fall far short of the air dominance force capacity needed to defeat Chinese aggression in the Pacific or a Russian attack against NATO and Europe. And that would translate directly to mission failures and possibly even a failed U.S. campaign, given that air dominance is a critical enabler of all joint operations.
Gonzo, thanks so much for that insight. The reality is that military leaders always need to prepare for a broad range of potential futures. The dollars they control in the federal budget process won't yield military capability for years. By the time they work their way through the procurement, production, and fielding process, let's face it, they're probably moved on to their next job. The process isn't fast and it isn't perfect, but it's the system we've got, so we've got to be smart about using it. Predicting the future is hard, so balance is key. Understanding how our Air Force is so far behind the technology and capacity needed to meet today's threats is a study in bad choices. There's not a better example of how these things unfolded other than looking at the F-22. Now, I want to be clear. I am not here to highlight the F-22's challenges because I'm a fighter pilot and I want to talk about a fighter jet. This is a crucial example because its history epitomizes the very dynamics that led to such a fragile Air Force. We designed an incredible aircraft that meets requirements. We began producing it, and then we truncate the buy because alternative priorities pop up and we want to save some cash. We forget about the long game, and we ultimately dug a hole, and that's where we are now. The mission demand still exists, which means we need this jet badly, and we need more of them, and we simply don't have enough. We have got to stop doing this. A key part of the aerospace advantage is to bring important voices to the conversations who are no kidding experts and leaders. They've had a seat at the table, they've flown the missions, and they've made history. Today, it is my honor to introduce you to one of these leaders, General John Corley. He is a career fighter pilot, and he has served in multiple key leadership positions, including the Air Force Vice Chief of Staff and as the commander of Air Combat Command. Now, in the Air Force, we call that person COMAC. That's the organization within the Air Force that owns the bulk of combat aircraft. Now, I've been lucky to know and serve under General Corley for years, and he exemplifies what it means to be a leader, what it means to stand up and be counted on when the chips are down. And that's why I've asked him to join us today. Now, General Corley was heading up Air Combat Command when the fight over the F-22 was erupting. During that time, Congress asked him for his opinion, and he gave it. And that really took guts because his opinion ran contrary to what a lot of defense leaders were thinking at the time. So let's dig into this history so we can learn and fight for a better ending next time. Thinking about how clear your stance was then 10 years ago, what was your reasoning and assessment when you engaged with the Senate?
Sure. Slick, let me add a little color if I can, because I'm glad you brought up the point about it being a decade ago. I mean, essentially, we got the last F-22 for the United States Air Force in 2012. Now, the decision process that we're talking about really had occurred back in the 2008-2009 timeframe. So with respect to that environment and that timeline, I think we have to recall that the economy was really in the tank, if you will, that Americans were kind of suffering, and that conflict in Afghanistan had not and was not going well, that America's sons and daughters were being killed, that many of them were being maimed, that innocent civilians were also losing their lives. So to describe it that way, emotions were running pretty high, if you will. Now, that's much less the standard bureaucracy that you and Doug and Dan are so familiar with, which is the kind of Pentagon bureaucracy with endless debates over service equities and roles and missions. And also, very importantly, it was the competition for resources. Read money and not mission. Oftentimes, I think that was really a lot behind the F-22 decision. There were also some defense industry advocacy for others' programs as opposed to trying to support those that were currently the Air Force position. So despite maybe all of that bureaucracy, and I have to admit I was part of it in D.C. prior to my time as COMAC, my desire was that we would have this debate about the F-22. In fact, there had been Hill language 2 years earlier having the United States Air Force, through the Department of Defense, describe, if you will, the force structure required in terms of numbers of F-22 or its capacity, if you will. And I thought that debate should occur in a somewhat rational process. There's a guy by the name of Matt Pearsall down at UNC. I found a lot of value in what he used to say. He said, look, you need to clearly identify the problem. You need to identify the criteria for a successful solution to that problem. You need to identify the options that are going to be available to you and evaluate those options in light of the criteria. And we'd select an outcome that really maximizes the criteria. This is about national security. It's that important that we get it right. Now, clearly, it began to implode very rapidly, that this decision would not follow a slow and deliberate and rigorous analytical approach. That if we desire to examine the alternative F-22 force structures and the associated risks within budget constraints, to a degree we did that, but, and I got to say, we had did it both ACC and at Headquarters Air Force and in nearly a dozen studies, it was just that analysis was really discarded. Because in large measure, my sense is that this decision had already been made. And to underpin the decision that was made, Slick, instead of this, a narrative was developed, a kind of a political narrative, if you will, it was put in play and is used to support that decision that I believe was already made. That narrative argued really that the F-22 had reduced relevance, if you will, as it not deployed to the AOR. But you may recall that we whipsawed the first fighter wing's F-22s in its leadership. I remember a conversation with General Barrett, Brennan Barrett, where we said, "Brennan, it's time to spin up the F-22s. We're going to send them to the AOR at that time, Afghanistan, the Iraq area." And of course, Brennan responded back to me was, "Boss, are you about to pull the rug out from underneath me after yet but another failed attempt to be tasked to deploy and in turn have that deployment removed?" So even though it was said the F-22 had reduced relevance because it hadn't deployed to the AOR, frankly, they had not allowed it to deploy to the AOR. So also, when we think about F-22, we have to think about future conflicts that are, quote, are they going to be similar to the ones we're in Iraq and Afghanistan? I got to say, that was a little troubling to me. So we have to be aware of those false prophets that seem to think they understand what is going to be, if you will, the future and future needs of our tools of trade and the capacities that we need those in. It was felt like that the F-22, according to OSD, was in fact, would rob dollars from more pressing weapons programs that were needed for the conflict in Afghanistan. That the more money we spent on stuff that we don't need, the less we'll have available for stuff that we do. That studies, this really worried me, because I thought, at first when I heard the studies were, I thought it would be back to that rigorous analytical approach. But I was disappointed to hear that the studies had determined that 187 F-22s were sufficient to meet this evolving underlying U.S. military strategy. And that was in testimony. Of course, it turns out those really weren't studies, if you will, out of the Joint Staff. It was more documents, if you will, in terms of slides, almost bullet slides that were shown. So proliferating fighter across all three services would be of greater value than providing the force structure necessary to meet an operational demand of a service core function. Then finally, they got into the mode of, every time I tried to respond to each of these, I found it was like squeezing a balloon. It would just bulge out in another area, or playing whack-a-mole. You'd beat one of these narrative questions back, and then you get it back in another area. That to support combat commanders' EW request, it was more important to keep the F-18 assembly line hot than to procure additional F-22s for air superiority. So there was countless half-truths. There was a lot of misinformation that was out there. And this is not an exhaustive list, if you will. It's really only a brief set of items that came up. So with respect to the Senate, maybe getting more to the point, I was asked my personal opinion about the risk assessment of procuring no more than 187 F-22s. I was asked about my awareness of any studies that supported procuring only 187. While ACC really had provided the Air Force and its own studies, that studies really never were appropriate to 187. In essence, I was asked to provide my own best military advice. And I hope that the letter speaks to itself, that although we had that requirement for 381 to deliver that tailored package of air superiority to those combatant commanders, it's going to provide not just a tailored package of delivery of that air superiority through the F-22, it was to establish a potent, globally arrayed, asymmetric deterrent against potential adversaries. I found 187 F-22s would not support the current national military strategy, and certainly wouldn't support the evolving military strategy either. To my knowledge, Slick, there really wasn't a study that was going to demonstrate that. And we had done one at ACC. It was in concert with what had been done by A9 up in the Pentagon, and that was going to be more towards about 250-ish F-22s, well below the stated 381 requirement. So the desire was to say, what's acceptable risk? Acceptable risk came in at that sweet spot of 250, supported by the A9 study, supported by our studies at ACC, and others that were out there, like the RAND Corporation. So it wasn't just inside the Air Force, it was outside and external to the Air Force in terms of numbers. So I know that this is, if you will, a little bit trite to you guys, but I've always had the belief that to credibly deter, and if that deterrence fails, deliver on that freedom of action from the joint force is going to require that Air Force air superiority, a service core function, and a core function that would demand tools and trained airmen to underpin it. And tools and trained airmen, both in terms of the proper capabilities and with the right capacity. So, it's like, I'm sorry, it's a very long, brief scene setter or opener. Was that what was going on at the time? Does that help at all?
It absolutely does, sir. And I tell you, I'm just sitting back, taking in your perspective and really the visionary strategic thought that you had, because one of the things that we'll comment on during this podcast is the fact that the discussion really, instead of from a strategic viewpoint that you as leaders were looking at, and of course, General Mosley at the time, is the conversation quickly just went to an airplane and what the F-22 was capable of doing or not doing, its relevance in current warfare versus future warfare, et cetera. And I think that really is the quick way to kind of undermine the much broader view of what you all were trying to bring to the future fight. So that's going to lead me right into this next question for you, because you now have the benefit of hindsight, and it appears to us and everything that we've studied and everything that we're looking for, especially with the rising China, things that are going on in Europe vis-a-vis Russia, and how quickly Syria has grown, and we had F-22s fighting in that war zone, it seems like your assessment was right on the money. And given budget pressures that you faced then, and that's part of your opening discussion is what you talked about, I think 10 years later, our current leaders are going to find themselves dealing with the same budget constraints from things like COVID-19, et cetera. So my question is, what advice are you going to offer future leaders that are juggling these tough decisions, you know, from the lessons learned of your F-22 experience?
You know, Slick, that's an excellent point. When I think about what would be kind of my top 10 examples of this, and at a strategic level as well, I think people need to, number one, school or reschool themselves in how decisions are made at the highest levels of our government. And that you really have to, number two, maybe, if you will, engage and inform the debate early and repeatedly. I was reminded by a PA&E individual, a retired Marine 3-star, that said the Air Force had the opportunity to make the case for the F-22, but chose not to. That's a little worrisome to me. Now, the other thing is, don't accept somebody else's narrative. You know, when I was reading through the Zimes myself, I was sitting there thinking, many of these have been framing type of approaches to why the F-22 was not going to be of value, not of relevance, not of delivering on that, if you will, that tailored package of global, if you will, arrayed execution of our national military strategy and protection of that air superiority, a core function, that you got to demand well-reasoned and thoughtful information. And that's got to be backed by analytical rigor. I think this decision process, really, you should recognize when it starts to get hijacked, if you will, and when people get into the confirmation bias approach. In other words, what they're really doing is they're seeking to confirm their theories or their decisions, and they're avoiding seeking information that are going to disprove them or disconfirm them. Let me say another way, it's really theories test information rather than information to test our theories. So you've got to help your leadership weigh both the supporting and the unsupporting evidence. It's about national security. It's about the opportunity to perform missions across the full range of military operations. We are an air, space, and cyber force, and not just simply a niche force. You've got to look across that full range of military operations. You've got to not have the opportunity to only be able to participate in one very narrow segment of it. And it's not just simply about the fight tonight. You've got to remain future focused. And in the end, you got to summon the courage to always offer your best military advice. Because geopolitically, I think the world is more dangerous today than it's been. I mean, look in the Pacific theater alone. The Chinese threat is growing. The Chinese Communist Party is becoming more and more bold. They're ignoring international law. They're violating the norms of international cooperation. Our allies in the Pacific are scrambling to improve their own capabilities, recognizing that threat. Japan is improving its military, trying to protect those outlying islands Taiwan has agreed to a massive modernization package for its own military. The Australian Prime Minister has announced that he's increasing defense spending by 40% over the next 10 years. While all those actions are very positive, all eyes really ought to be on the United States and the United States Air Force, as no other nation or service can take up that leadership mantle.
Well, sir, again, I'm always just taken back by your perspective and such wonderful advice. Again, with your experience, what you dealt with the previous tremendously, I will say, poorly executed program such as the F-22, I think the takeaway is that we just cannot cancel and avoid the reality that we're facing. And the strategists are coming up with plans and numbers, looking at the future threat. And your point is very well taken amongst this crowd. So thank you for that perspective.
Yeah. Yeah. If I can just add to that, Slick, I think what has occurred here is that repeatedly we fall in love with the program next. And it's always the program next. And so you ultimately are left with no program. That is a worrisome thing to me. If you recall the original Advanced Tactical Fighter program, as this development was starting in the 80s, it was to ensure U.S. air superiority, that enduring, if you will, necessity and core function. But it was also about the ability to counter those growth of advanced air defenses. Those are proliferated around the world now, not just in countries like China and Russia. They were allowed to have the timely retirement of the F-15 Eagle, who's gotten so old at the present time. Its viability would be really in question. So that was the original vision. And if you go back to that vision, it was fairly strong, if you will.
Now, just to drive this point home, this fight was not over an airplane. It was about a strategic worldview. And it wasn't restricted to the F-22 alone. The Air Force also lost a bomber modernization effort during this time, and it was forced to retire hundreds of line combat aircraft to free up money for the fights in Iraq and Afghanistan. Fundamentally, the DoD saw the immediate conflicts, while the Air Force recognized there were broader security dynamics at play around the world. This fight ultimately grew so heated that it cost Secretary of the Air Force Mike Wynn and Chief of Staff of the Air Force General Buzz Mosley their jobs. At the same time the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq were underway, America's competitors recognized that these conflicts presented them with an opportunity. Countries like China and Russia accelerated their own defense technology programs to nullify advantages once held unilaterally by the United States. They invested in everything from militarizing space to new nuclear weapons, fighter planes, bombers, airlift, naval power, and cyber capabilities. Leaders like Wynn, Mosley, Corley, and others were ultimately right, and the long game proved it. The irony of all of this is that in the wake of the F-22 cancellation and related modernization decisions, top American officials began to wake up to the reality of the broader global threat landscape. The shift in strategic thinking became clear when in the fall of 2011, then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton announced a pivot to Asia. The very theater things like the F-22 and advanced bombers and tankers were essentially to bring capability and capacity to. This statement immediately created waves in Washington, and it was the beginning of a major revector. However, its immediate impact stalled thanks to the Budget Control Act. Another window of opportunity for modernization passed, and the can was kicked into the 2020s. Now, why does reflecting on this experience matter? Frankly, it looks like we're heading back down this road again. Just look at today's headlines. Things like COVID-19 related spending and a cratering economy are going to drive very hard defense spending decisions. Folks will want to cut, and we will have to answer the call for modernization again. That's why we need programs like the B-21, F-35, KC-46, T-7, and more. Because our adversaries are not going to go away. They hold that card, and they are playing it. It will always be more expensive to come back and try to fill an unmet requirement a few years later. You lose all of the benefits of the research and development investment, and you need to come up with a new design and set up another production line. All of that just to get back to where you were at the point of cancellation a few years back. You've also surrendered time, invested a ton of money limping along older jets that should have been retired, and you're kicking the can on other modernization priorities that now don't have money. It's just smarter and cheaper to buy what you need up front. This is what it all comes down to. Air Force leaders know they face a critical moment where the decisions they make today will fundamentally shape the options available to their successors in years to come. As the 21st Chief of Staff of the Air Force, General David Goldfein explained.
Yeah, I'm the 21st Chief of Staff. In 2030, Chief 24 will go to war with the force I built. If we go to war this year, I will go to war with the force that John Jumper and Mike Ryan built. Such is the nature of lead time for building air forces.
So here we stand. Let's face it. The history we've just reviewed is far from a happy story. However, we need to look at the present environment as an opportunity. Together, we will explore where we're going to go and why, both from the human and technological perspective. Now that we understand the recent history, our next episode will see us focus on the threats and how we need to manage the challenges they present. Former Undersecretary of Defense, Dr. Jim Miller, who served during the Obama administration, will be joining us for how he worked to prepare for what we face today and his take on the current state of play. As always, we look forward to continuing this journey with you. The reality is America faces a very challenging set of realities. Leaders will need the best air and space capabilities available to give us the fighting advantage we need. We need to focus on acquiring tomorrow's Air Force today before it's too late. So as I used to say in my F-16, fights on. Thank you, our listeners, for tuning in today, and a big thank you to Gonzo and General Corley for being part of the Aerospace Advantage podcast. As always, you can join in on the conversation by following us on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, and now Instagram, or also by visiting us online at MitchellAerospacePower.org. Until next time, this is Slick Baum. Have a great Aerospace PowerCon a day, and check six.